Welcome back, guys. Business Untitled. You know, a lot of people told me that I cuss a lot on here, and I want to repent and stop cussing. Everyone cusses, but you know what really hit me was my friend, one of my really, really good friends, Antonil. I won't say his last name, but he's just as hood as I am, just as smart as I am, probably smarter in a lot of ways. And he said to me, he said, yo, you know, everybody curse on the show, but when you curse, it just hit different. And coming from him, a lot of people told me, but coming from him, who I was like, is just like me, it hit me different. And I was like, you know what? I got to stop cursing. Fuck, I got to stop cursing. But we created a swear jar. And the swear jar, I don't think we have an amount that we put in it. We put 20, it's a couple hundreds in here. But we're going to fold this. Everybody who cusses on the show, and including myself, Mike, Dave, we're going to fold this. And hopefully this will be worth $4,000 to $5,000 because there's no amount, it's no dollar amount that we put in there. We just put money in our pocket. One lucky subscriber is going to get picked, and they're going to get this $5,000 and get up. We're gonna, you know what? I'm gonna add some shit to it. It should count.
Yes.
Shit. So more money for the swear jar, and our guys in the back are added up, and we put it in every day. We're gonna fly that person to us if they're not in New York, and we're gonna give them the swear jar on the show, and they're gonna get a chance to meet us. So hopefully this thing will have $5,000. Shout out to my boy Antonil. Well, we're back again. Business Untitled. Episode, you know what? We did so many episodes, I'm losing track of it. But our guy just said 20. Wow, 20 episodes. This is so dope that we somehow made it to 20 episodes. But Mike, you're on Forbes again in a big way, and Bitcoin exploded. What's happening?
I think it exploded because I was on Forbes.
Are you rich again?
No. Listen, you know, this has been a great quarter for Bitcoin, a great month for Bitcoin, a great month for crypto. Why is it happening? It's really kind of simple. The ETF, you know, got launched, and you know, when it first came out, there were people that had front ran the ETF. There were people that were nervous about the ETF. And so price went up, price went down, and all of a sudden, the people that had to sell have sold, and there's just new buyers coming in every day, and you can see it every single day. You can add up the 9 different ETFs, and it's $400 million in the space, $500 million in the space. I learned early on from my friend Paul Tudor Jones that prices are set on the margin. What I mean by that is, like, if there are 10 buyers and 10 sellers, and all of a sudden two more buyers come, it drives the price up until there's sellers. And so it's asymmetric. It doesn't mean you can get a billion, 2 billion, 10 billion of market cap in a day or in a week with far less buying than that, yeah. Right? And so you saw it in NVIDIA, who had a day where it went up $240 billion in one day. Wow. And we're seeing it in crypto right now. And it feels like this momentum is picking up, not slowing down. We're at 54,000 today. If you look on the charts, it's not going to go in a direct line, but it will get to 69,000, the old high. At that point, it probably pauses, maybe comes back, everyone takes some profit, and then it's going to keep going higher. And so this is the year for crypto, baby.
Can you talk about the ETFs a little bit more? You know, exchange-traded funds, why is that so important in this context?
Yeah, so if you're young, if you're Gen Z, millennial, and you wanted to buy Bitcoin, you have probably bought it on Robinhood or through your Square app, on Coinbase. PayPal, Coinbase, Gemini. There have been so many places to buy it. But the bulk of the wealth in America, a giant amount, $45 trillion, is owned by baby boomers. Wow. People that are 50, well, unfortunately 59, you know, to 75, 80. They own the money. They own the money for a bunch of reasons. They were there when the markets went up. They have the biggest amount of people. That's why they call the baby boomers. And they're old, right? You accumulate more assets as you get old. They do their buying and selling through what we used to call stockbrokers. Barry Bias spent his whole career as a stockbroker, right? You talk to wealthy people and tell them what you think they should buy and sell. They're called registered investment advisors. And right now, their weapon of choice is the ETF. The ETF is basically taking a commodity or an asset and making it just as easy as a stock to buy. So they've taken Bitcoin and say, if you want to buy Bitcoin, you just need to buy this ETF, which is a stock. So you call your stockbroker, you can get leverage on it. He just picks up the phone and there's no new account set up. You don't worry about custody, all the stuff that felt like voodoo to old people, felt like very easy to understand to young people. And so all these old people are starting to buy crypto. And their brokers are saying, just put 1 or 2% of your portfolio in.
But that's a lot of money.
That's a lot of money when you're talking $45
trillion. And wow. Talk about, like, so Bitcoin is in an ETF. What about, say, Ethereum, right? The next biggest one, or Solana. How come Bitcoin's in one and Solana and Ethereum
Bitcoin,
aren't?
Because it's the first brand. I always say it's maybe the best brand that's been created on this planet in the last 100 years. The fastest, right? I mean, it's whatever, 14 years old and, you know, over $1 trillion of market cap. And it's known around the world. It's got now 250 million people that own some piece of a Bitcoin. ETF for Ethereum is coming. It's been filed. One of the reasons Ethereum has had such a good run recently, right? It's gone from 2000 to 3100 is people are anticipating, hey, that's next. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there'll be more and more ETFs down the road. It's going to start with Bitcoin, then Ethereum, but it wouldn't surprise me if Solana has an ETF at one point.
Right.
Did you just say $4 or $5 trillion when you said they're putting 1% of, people are saying put 1%, their brokers are saying put 1%?
No,
you said
if you have $45 trillion of
45 worth, trillion.
10% is $4.5 trillion, 1% would be $450 billion.
Okay, so that was my question. I thought you said $45 trillion, but I said that would be crazy. But you did say $45 trillion.
$45 trillion.
So they're putting 1% of $45 trillion, which is $4 or $5 trillion,
no,
right?
It'd be $450 billion.
So okay, $450 billion. And is that controlled by the baby boomers? $45 trillion, or you're just saying?
Yeah, $45 trillion is controlled by baby boomers,
which is people over 50 years old.
60.
Over 60 years old.
Yeah.
So $45 trillion is controlled by people that are over 60 years old.
Yeah, we should double check that number so I'm not, you know, out, but I think that's the right number. Someone Google that.
Try not to cuss, that is crazy.
Right, listen, America has a lot of wealth.
Yeah.
We're the wealthiest country on the planet. The average American, I think average American wealth is around $450,000. So every family, that means after the debt, right? So you take your real estate and your stocks and your cash and your art minus your mortgage and your other debt, that's your net wealth. And, you know, for America, that's a pretty high number.
So let me ask this, right? So Ethereum, Solana coming, part of it is because Bitcoin is considered not a security, correct? So
right.
It's not a security. That's why they're right. Ethereum, that ruling has not been made yet, right?
Not happened.
Talk about that a little
bit. Gary Gensler, before he was at the SEC, said Ethereum is definitely not a security. Since he's been at the SEC, he said, we're not so sure. And
why is this important?
Well, it's important because we've got arcane laws in America, right, from the 1940s that define what's a security and what's not a security. And if you're not a security, the SEC doesn't regulate you. You're regulated if you're a commodity by the CFTC. If you're a security, you get regulated by the SEC. And how things are launched, how money is raised, is really governed by that. And so because a lot of these tokens happened before we had a regulatory framework, you're not positive what's a security and what's not a security. And so you can get in big trouble if you're the issuer, mm-hmm. or at times even the bank that participates buying and selling mm-hmm. in things that are unregistered securities.
Mm-hmm.
It's been kind of, I would actually pay the fine, but I'm not going to curse. It's been BS that our Congress and our SEC and our CFTC haven't gotten together and passed laws to make it clearer for you, for me, for businesses mm-hmm. like mine, you know, what the rules are.
Mm-hmm.
And so we kind of guessing what we think the rules are. And you know, some companies like Coinbase have been really aggressive in saying, you guys, these are what we think the rules are, and we're going to play by them, and we don't care what you think. Mm. We'll sue you. You can sue us. We'll sue you back. Mm-hmm. Other companies have been more conservative. But it's made it really, really challenging. And I think the SEC's worry about declaring Ethereum a security, is it opens up the door for lots of other what's called proof of stake tokens to say, well, we're just like that. Like, right. What's the rule now?
Yeah.
And so it's a slippery slope until we get Congress to set guidelines. Mm-hmm. I think that will happen at the end of the after the election. Mm-hmm.
So, correction, 78, somebody just told me, $78 trillion is controlled by baby boomers.
$78 trillion.
Which is half the wealth of the country, right?
Right.
So how does that...
The 45 might be non-real estate.
Yeah. Whatever, 45, right. 78. How does that, for Gen Z or for anyone else, I don't want to say feel fair, but what do you do? Just kind of wait for your parents to die?
Like, yes.
Yeah, but let me say something first of all. Like, compounding interest says that if I start investing when I'm 21 years old and it's 60 years later, I'm going to have a lot of money. I'm going to have a lot more money than like a 25-year-old that's only been investing for 4 years. So there is a part of it where naturally, right,
in this world. Old people should be richer than young.
Yeah, in this world.
And I
don't have earning capacity anymore either. So the other side of that is making sure that there's enough wealth in, you know, old people to take care of themselves, retire, et cetera, things like that. So that's part of why there's so much wealth up there.
We are about to enter the single greatest wealth transfer in the history of planet Earth. As baby boomers die off, and they will die, one thing that is sure, everybody dies. That wealth is going to get shifted to millennials and Gen Z. And so, you know, in some ways, you're your come on, Grandpa. I mean, that's the reality of it, right? Charlie Munger just died at what was close to 100 years old.
Yeah.
He had $40 billion. That money's going somewhere. He's not taking it to heaven with him.
Right. So odds are you're going to say Ethereum is going to be, effectively ETF. They're going to say it's a commodity, not a security. It's decentralized enough. And
the Ethereum argument is a little bit
up level one.
A little bit challenging tokens. Because the reason Bitcoin was able to become an ETF was because there was already a futures ETF approved.
Right. And Bitcoin, I think it's very hard to say it's like centralized and controlled by one party, right? Like there's a test for securities. Yeah. I forget the Howey test.
The Howey test.
Yeah, or whatever it is. And so Ethereum, it gets onto a more slippery slope. But anyway, market says you think that Ethereum will get to that same treatment, basically.
Yeah.
Talk about level ones in general, about why is Bitcoin even different than Ethereum? As long as we're on crypto, let's just do a real quick primer on it.
Yeah, listen, so in general, each of these ecosystems are a story. They're a narrative. The Bitcoin narrative, it came first, was we're going to be the first decentralized money. And I'm going to bring people into my community who believe the story I'm telling. Right, the value of Bitcoin doesn't come from this amazing technology. That's a necessary part of it, but it comes from the social construct that you and I trust each other, that we can say, hey, I believe this has value and you believe it has value, therefore it has value, and we're going to trust this decentralized system of cryptography that once we say it, it's actually, in essence, the Constitution is built into the code. Ethereum has its own code. In its own constitution, in its own community, in all of these other blockchains, which are in essence a version of the same thing. It's a shared database that a community comes around and says, hey, this database is important to us. They all have a story of what they're going to be used for. Mm-hmm. Most of the level ones say, we want to be the supercomputer that processes and stores all your data because we think we can store data faster and more fair and more equitable than the companies right now that are storing data, which are usually governments or Facebook or these big siloed governments or siloed actors that can manipulate, own, and keep your data, right? During COVID, the Canadians said, hey, if you're a trucker protesting the vax mandates and you're blocking, we're going to freeze your checking accounts. You're like, you can't freeze my money. Like, oh, yeah, we can, right? They had access to that data. Mm-hmm. In India, Modi decided, the guys up in Kashmir really pissed me off. He literally erased 9 million people from the country's database. So you guys no longer exist. Well, India is the first country that has a centralized digital ID for everybody. So if you want to get your benefits, you need your ID number. Someone just stole my ID number. From something as simple as a college transcript, right? Like at one point, you know, people lie about their transcripts. You call the university. Hey, did that guy really get all A's? Oh, no, he was a C student.
Yeah.
You know, that's all going to be on a blockchain. Even though right. we trust our universities, yeah. they're probably not going to lie. Why do I have to trust them when it could all be put on a blockchain?
Right.
And so theoretically, all these blockchains can be used to guard, store, and protect our data.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
That's the narrative that they all sell.
Yeah. I think one thing that you have to keep in mind is in the United States, there is a lot of trust in institution, pretty much, right? You don't think your bank's going to wipe you out, your university's
not going
to wipe
you out. Yeah, but it's breaking down. Like,
it is breaking down. But I'm saying if you're in another country, if you're in Venezuela, if you're in Argentina, if you're in, you know, China, right? There's a lot of other places where that trust doesn't exist. So having this system, right, this eventually self-executing system is
you can look at the price of Bitcoin, which was created in 2009 after the financial
crisis.
Who
was it created by?
Satoshi Nakamoto.
Is that really true, or that's a myth? Or does anyone know if that's true or it's a myth?
There, somebody created it and put this constitution, this white paper in the
ecosystem.
Okay,
so who was Ether created by?
A guy named Vitalik Buterin.
Solana.
Anatoly.
So every single one of these blockchains, any cryptocurrency, we know exactly who created
it. Other than Bitcoin.
Other than Bitcoin. Is there not like a worry somewhere that someone created it, has the keys for it, right?
Well, so there's a thing called the
take it or manipulate it when it becomes strong enough.
Right? Satoshi's wallet has a gigantic amount of Bitcoin. And there was always the fear he might sell it. I personally think the keys were lost. Satoshi died. He's never wanted it because there's no way you could be patient enough to sit on that big of a stack and not sell any.
What if it's China? I'm just saying you don't know. No one knows.
Well, there are people that were around at the beginning, right? And so one of my classmates from Princeton was one of the guys who Satoshi trusted a bunch of things with. They're guys that started mining. And so there was a community of people that were participating. Remember, this was small fry stuff.
Yeah.
Small fry stuff. Why there's some people that are worth 100 million, a billion, 5 billion, 10 billion that you never heard of, it's because they started mining Bitcoin when it was 25 cents, 30 right. cents, a dollar. I got friends that are worth billions of dollars because they bought Bitcoin when it was $2.
Yeah.
Right? I bought it at $100. People have bought it at $1,000. It's now $54,200. So imagine if you bought it at 37 cents.
So there's no, to answer the question,
there's no worry.
No, obviously I'm joking with that. But there's no worry that because you don't actually know who has the keys for it, it's kind of a myth who has the keys
for
it.
Well, listen, if there was a Satoshi sitting on that pile, all he could do was say, okay, I'm going to sell my Bitcoin.
Yeah.
He couldn't change the ecosystem.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what's important to understand. It just means some guy may or may not have $100 billion.
And what's most likely is that Bitcoin is in essence gone for good. It just sits there. No one's going to do anything with it. Like you think there's estimates that of the 21 million Bitcoin, right, 19.5 million have already been mined, that there's 2 to 3 million that were just lost, right? What, it was 37 cents. You put it on your freaking computer. Your computer breaks. Right. You're not even worried about it. There's stories of guys literally have spent millions of dollars going through dumps because the guys, I had all this Bitcoin on my computer and I threw my computer away. And I mean, we've got guys that come in our office and beg us to help get it off their treasures or their computers because they forgot their passwords or codes.
What's the most a guy personally lost in Bitcoin that just can't access it?
A couple million bucks.
Crazy. Yeah.
But the system itself is very transparent, secure.
Yeah.
Right? That's the whole
thing. But I was just wondering if that was a possibility. It's a fair question.
Yeah.
Bitcoin was really created, right? In specific, I think there's a lot of confusion around this thing of cryptocurrency because it was created kind of with the money supply.
Bitcoin was created as the first decentralized money.
Right.
And so if you read the Bitcoin white paper, it literally is an economic paper.
Yes.
When Vitalik Buterin, who is this genius, he's my hero of the entire space. He is such an ethical dude. He's the first guy that's post money. He doesn't care about money. He could launch a project tomorrow and take billions, and he just doesn't care about the money. He cares about the revolution. So he looked at Bitcoin and said, oh my God, this is an amazing technological breakthrough and an amazing sociological breakthrough. But the Bitcoin code and the way it's structured doesn't really work to be decentralized everything. So he added a thing called a smart contract onto a blockchain and created Ethereum to be much more adaptable, to be able to not just have zeros and ones and money on your blockchain, but to have code, to have photos, to have anything you want, to have contract law, to have. And so his vision was, we're going to have this decentralized database, this supercomputer that everything gets built on.
Right.
And that's really why I got excited about this revolution. I would not have spent the last 12 years of my life in crypto if it was just because we're creating a casino,
yeah,
or we're creating a new monetary system.
Yeah. Yeah.
The monetary system is pretty cool with Bitcoin, but the real revolution comes to, and it hasn't happened yet, right?
Right.
So far, Bitcoin has happened. NFTs, to a degree, they came and went. They got a little too speculative. Payments, right? All around the world, people are moving around dollars, U.S. dollar, you know, synthetic dollars, USDC or Tether, on different blockchains, right? The number one blockchain for payments right now, shockingly enough, is a blockchain called Tron. And people use Tether on Tron all over Africa, all over the Middle East to move money around. But it hasn't happened in the stuff that we thought the revolution would, in music, in ticketing, in decentralized ride sharing, in lots of other parts of finance.
Back it up for a second, because I don't think you've like put the leap together, right? Like, just talk about Ethereum for one second, right? It's like basically like a protocol, so to speak, right? That you can build smart contracts,
yes,
and launch any business on. In theory, you can do that with Bitcoin, but it was created for like this single purpose, basically like a monetary system. So it's not as smart as an Ethereum system in that context. But I think what is missing about the narrative sometimes in the public is everyone thinks of it all as cryptocurrency, which puts them in this casino mindset effectively. And it doesn't allow you to like basically recognize the actual utility of the blockchain. And that's a problem with the narrative.
One of the things that I think is interesting is, so when I started selling Bitcoin and then Ethereum, and when I say selling, I was kind of like a preacher, right? Trying to explain to people and get them excited. I really believed that Bitcoin would be the only crypto that would have value as a store of value. When you look at the periodic table of elements, there's 114 elements. Gold is the only one that has value because it's got value.
Scarce.
The rest are also scarce, need a utility for people to care about them, right? We use copper for all kinds of things. That's why people buy copper. They don't buy copper just to hold it. And so my original thesis was, and I think in the long run this will probably hold true, was that Ethereum needs its own utility, and it's got one. And every crypto was going to need some utility, right? We saw Uniswap, which is this decentralized exchange, jump in value because finally it's paying out some of the profits from commissions that people use. But that was a utility. It's creating this unbelievable exchange where you can trade anything, not just cryptos, but at one point you'll be able to trade anything. And so, but what's happened is because of the way crypto works, the more people that buy your token, the higher the price goes, the more you get excited about it. You've got an incentive to get other people involved and tell that story. We've had lots of different crypto ecosystems that fight with each other that all have some store of value to them, right? Dogecoin is still a $10 billion ecosystem.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because the people that buy it care about it in the same way the people that buy a lot smaller than Bitcoin, right? Bitcoin's $1.1 trillion. But there's currencies like Cardano, yeah, which the guy Charles Hoskinson, he was one of the Ethereum guys, and he spun out and did his own. And his team is passionate about what Cardano is going to be used for. I don't think Cardano will be used for much.
Yeah.
But it still has a lot of value. And so we've debased, it's like meme stocks. We've debased what people think of value. Gen Z and millennials think very differently about what they want to own. And so you've got what I would have thought would have been crazy passion and crazy valuations around lots of tokens that don't really have a utility yet. They might have a utility in the future, and they have a story of utility, but they have no utility yet.
Well, I think the narrative has been dominated by like the casino aspect of this, not the utility aspect of this. And so even when you put Doge, for instance, in the same breath as Ethereum or Solana, right? It doesn't deserve to be in the same breath. It's speculative. It has no functionality. The founders themselves admit that it has no functionality. I'm saying Dogecoin, right? And so what I think confuses the public about this to an extent is they can't figure out the difference between like utility versus speculation in the tokens. Wow. And so everybody puts all this, lumps all this stuff into one bucket, and it's not one bucket.
And it's,
some of this stuff will be Amazon and some of this stuff will be pets.com.
What's surprising to me is how resilient these other ecosystems have been, right?
Why do you think that is? Is it just because
of we got 8 billion
storytelling and community building?
We've got 8 billion people on the planet. If you go back and read, you know, Yuval Harari and Sapiens, we are a, you know, Homo sapiens are people of stories.
Yeah.
And these are interesting stories. And now I've got a vested interest.
Well, so let's talk about, if we're going to talk about use case on crypto, right? I'm going to switch on it. But Supreme Court today took two cases, one out of Texas, one out of Florida, right? Basically, with that issue, whether the states can regulate social media, the content of social media. Both Texas and Florida passed laws that said that Facebook, YouTube are not allowed to moderate content, that they must allow views to be expressed. They can't moderate by location, they can't moderate by views, etc. And it's a really complicated question because when these laws protecting social media were passed, like Section 230, we talked about it another time, you know, it was 30 years ago, so the internet was very different. And so this idea of like, and I'm going to get to why it's I think a little bit interesting regarding crypto, but these networks have such power now, and what started out as this is kind of a game, or it's just sharing picture files or what have you, is now like dominating democracy. It's dominating information. It's really like gating access. It's gating money basically on what those algorithms are, right? So the structure of that network and the network effect power of Facebook, of YouTube, Google is immense. It's impenetrable. And so when you look at the NASDAQ, you look at the valuations, five companies basically have all five, six, seven
Which
companies.
Which five companies?
Google, Meta, Amazon, Apple, Microsoft.
Would you say these five companies or six or seven, whatever it is as powerful or more powerful than the government or some governments? Because I have a friend now, he says, right? He always says this to me. He said, the world is so different and the people at the top don't realize it. The world isn't run from the top down anymore. It's run from the bottom up, which means social media controls the narrative of what has to be changed in a sense, or what has to be the voice that's echoed.
And who controls that? But,
right, but and who controls social media?
The bottom.
Mark Zuckerberg controls Meta.
It's controlled by five or six guys.
Elon controls Twitter, right?
Let me just go on this for one second.
Somebody talk more about that.
So what I'm saying is
the only thing I want to add to that is, and I want to break this down for myself, right? All the viewers get it, but I don't get it, right? Because when you say it's controlled by six or seven guys, I'm thinking I'm using my phone, putting up a post, and I went viral, and now I'm controlling something. So are you saying that these five or six guys in these companies, or maybe it's bots, maybe it's whatever, even could make me think that I am pushing a narrative that they pushed on me that
100%.
I don't even understand the narrative that I'm pushing because, maybe I'm not saying it right.
No, but I understand what you're saying. Number one, yes, they're influencing your thoughts, right? But second, I'm saying like—
Can you touch on that a little bit?
Well, it's like, I got a great example.
Yeah, go on.
So listen, you know, this is going to be sensitive and I'm going to get yelled at for saying this. October 7th, right? Hamas attacks Israel, horrible terrorist attack. And normal reaction would have been like, oh my God, look at this. And I flew over to Israel 10 days, 12 days afterwards and saw what happened. It was horrific. I saw the film. I visited all the kibbutz Be'eri. I went there to bear witness. And I started watching how fast the youth of America was changing their mind about what happened, right? There was posts that Osama bin Laden was right all along, and there was like a whole little bin Laden thing that showed up. And there was this, listen, it's a very complicated issue. The Palestinians have a right to be unbelievably upset. The Israelis have a right to be unbelievably upset. You know, there's no right or wrong here. But how fast the narrative shifted on social media, on TikTok especially, that this was, it felt anti-Semitic and very, very pro-Hamas. And I recently sat with a woman who's a friend, who is sharp as can be, who had been the Undersecretary of Treasury for counterterrorism. So she is not a, under Trump. So she is not a flake. She is a stone cold serial killer when it comes to understanding things. And she was like, oh my goodness, TikTok, controlled by the Chinese, pushed this narrative so fast and so hard that within 2 weeks, every single part of the algorithm was showing this stuff.
Yeah, and simple, and stupid for me. What do you mean they pushed it? How did they push it?
When you start scrolling and you get a story, what stories are you getting? They were pushing these stories of, you know, that felt anti-Semitic, that felt all the blame was on Israel, that it was, that, you know, that, that, and it created this movement. And she said, like, categorically this happened. And it, TikTok, in this case, was far, far worse than Instagram and Facebook and the other ones.
But effectively, it's confirmation bias. It's psychological. If you get enough stuff pushed to you, like, you're going to believe that. Like, you have no idea why the moon is the moon, or, you know, you just see something in the sky, right? I'm just saying, like, you have to learn things, right? And the more information is repeated by credible sources or just any source, you know, so at the end of the day, these algorithms have the ability, they're not neutral, they basically are geared to push certain information at you that you're going to like. Some of it's because they want to market to you, they want to sell to you, they want to influence you. There's a lot of reasons. And another one I'll tell you is there's all these creators that helped create YouTube, for instance, or helped create Instagram. But at some point in time, it's in Instagram's interest to just say, oh, we're just not going to make them as relevant anymore. There's no value. You can't take any of that value that you've created away from the network at the end of the day. I mean, this is a slightly different point. Yeah. But effectively, these networks have so much power. So if you've amassed 1 million followers on Instagram and then you get mad about the terms of service because they switch it, or if you're trying to start a business on an app store, on Apple's app store, to switch off of social media onto that, and they're charging you 30% of your revenues, you really don't have another alternative. And so so getting back to that case, it's a really complicated animal what needs to be done with these networks right now, right? So states are starting to say, look, we don't trust that Meta or Twitter, on the right or the left, whatever you want to say, is curating and moderating this content without either advertent or inadvertent influences, right? And so they're trying to say every piece of content has to be pushed. That's what the Texas law and the Florida law effectively say, that Meta Meta's not allowed to basically show you some content and hide other content based on what they think is, like, acceptable, right? And so there's a suit going up, which has now just been heard by the Supreme Court today.
Conservative states think these liberal companies based in San Francisco are showing more liberal stuff, not conservative stuff. Right? So they're passing this law, right? Places like Facebook, I think we were talking about this, have 15,000
content moderators.
Yeah. So listen, I knew the woman that left a big job in news to try to run Facebook News and make sure, like, people there aren't saying, let's do this purposely and push fake news and not push other news. These are giant beasts that are literally, like, in some ways uncontrollable at this point. There's so many people participating on them.
And I think I'll take the switch off of this. Yeah. This is such a mind fuck, right? Because I'll take the switch off. Because even for me, like, it's so weird, because when I look, and let's get off of Israel and Palestine for a second, but anything that's being pushed to me, right? I can't even comprehend at times. And I'm in this circle where
Trump versus Biden right now.
No, Trump versus Biden, right? Yeah. I'm saying, for me, Like even with you, we were talking the other day.
With the bed?
With the bed, right? Yeah. Tell that story real quick.
Yeah, because a lot of it's commercial too. Like I was talking to somebody, somebody shared a photo with me, not on the Instagram platform, about some design inspiration for like something to do with work, like a bed or a bedroom set. And that same photo showed up in my Instagram feed a day later, which I'm just like, I don't know what pieces came together to make that happen, but that's the control that the networks have to push to you, sometimes for just commercial purposes, other times for influence purposes. And even if it's not intentional, the fact is it's still influence. I mean, it is intentional many times.
It is intentional.
When it has to do with selling.
Wait, wait, let me say this. Yeah. Here's the thing, right?
Yeah.
The narrative is, right, why things go viral on Twitter. It's like, we are free. So we are woke, right? And everything is, I'm woke, I'm woke, I'm woke. You can't put me to sleep anymore. But in all reality, we're so unwoke because we're being manipulated.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And it's hard to tell somebody who after 20 years just said, yeah, now I'm woke. You can't stop me because I could post, I could this, I could that. It's free. It's freedom of speech. You can't, how do you... It's such a crazy manipulation because you can't tell somebody who just discovered, who think they discovered they're woke, that in all reality, you're not woke. You're being controlled way more than you ever was in life. How do you even tell that story to someone who...
Well, this is how we're telling that story. I'm telling you that story right now. This is what's going on.
No one's
going
to believe you.
Well, Florida, Texas sued, right, basically to require that twice a year, Twitter, Facebook, these big platforms show how their algorithms work because nobody knows how it works. You know, you could say, and effectively, there's so much embedded in this. They can't be held for liable. There's a lot of technical questions around this, but all we know is that they're much more important than they were ever thought to be. And at this point in time, it's a big giant mess, effectively,
and like,
of manipulation.
Elon, I believe, I could be wrong on this, he said, hey, I'm going to put my algorithms open source. Anyone can look at my algorithms. Well, how in God's name are you and me or Dave, who aren't computer programmers, going to look at algorithms and understand what they are, right? All I know is, since he's taken over Twitter, it has become really, you know, alt-right almost. It has become really conservative, really anti-woke, really...
So you agree that they should?
Well, I think there's got to, just opening your algorithms to open source doesn't necessarily really help most users because we don't know how these algorithms work. Maybe they should have to explain them verbally.
Yeah, that's what they have to do. But in this law, I'm just saying what it's doing is it's saying, and again, I look, it's really complicated. I can't say either
it
way.
Is
but
so
what,
complicated.
But what they are saying is that they need to allow all viewpoints to be represented. They're not allowed to moderate or clip content anymore based on... Now, listen, there's certain things you're not allowed to say. You're not allowed to sex traffic. You're not allowed to incite violence. You're not allowed to commit criminality.
You can't yell that's fire all, at a crowded movie theater, right?
So there's certain exceptions. There's certain exceptions to free speech, okay? But I'm saying, like, in this context, I think it's a really interesting question what the Supreme Court's going to do with this, because these networks, at the end of the day, they have so much power. The reason I'm bringing it back to blockchain is they can change... The other thing is they can change the rules on you at any time. You... Armel at Instagram, Mike at Instagram, Mike at Twitter, they can take it away from you. They can shadow ban you. You don't even know. Listen, we had Drea DiMatteo on here. She was saying she was shadow banned after she came out against the vaccine. She didn't even know why. She just wasn't getting any followers, wasn't getting any push. You can't see that, right? So if we flip it back to
blockchain.
Well, blockchain, yeah, because the first fact is these networks are incredibly powerful. Nobody knows how to regulate them or control them, and it's a concern. Doesn't matter right, left, whatever. There's a lot of power in these things for commercial, political purposes, whatever. Second is like, okay, how do you solve it? One way to solve it is regulation. That's what Texas and Florida tried to do. Regulation's always tough. The governments can never catch up. It's just a big mess, right? Another way is to try to start a network on another platform. And I want to make one other point, which is when emails and websites started, before anybody knew what the internet was, there was a protocol, right? HTML, HTTP, that effectively governs the distribution of websites. And so you can get a website, you pay $10 for it, You can move it around. Nobody's going to take it away from you. It's a really, it's a protocol that's fair and logical and understandable in a sense. It doesn't have the same risks that a TikTok, a YouTube, a Google, you know, places like that do, where you can all of a sudden have the rules changed on you and someone can either shadow ban you or take it away. And so getting back to crypto and Ethereum, the dream for Ethereum is you can take a company like Uber, a network like social media, a banking payment system, whatever it is, build it on top of this protocol where it's got set rules that you know can't be changed unless the community changes them. And maybe that's a world in which another network presents itself on top of crypto and creates a utility case.
So how does these networks, social networks, not just say, hey, it's my platform, don't use it?
They do.
They do.
No, I'm saying
that's why they're
if
so
the government, if the Supreme Court is trying to hold them accountable for it, how is, you know, the argument not just don't use my platform?
At what point do they become public forums, right?
Yeah. They are, 100%, right? Yeah, so, but it's still privately owned for the most part, or whatever, yeah, traded. They can still say it's just my platform.
I'll give
don't
you an example.
Use it.
So in networks, cellular networks, telephone systems, right? You are not allowed to regulate content. They're called common carriers, right? That's something where we agree that nobody can exist in this world without being able to use a telephone. And so they're not allowed to regulate any content. There's an exception for them, right? Even universities, there's an exception where you're not really allowed to regulate content as a university. Anybody is supposed to be allowed to speak because it's considered like part of the public trust, part of the public square. Newspapers, you are allowed to regulate, because it's editorial. So this is my viewpoint, right?
Yeah.
Social media falls in a place where you don't quite know if it's a newspaper or a cellular network. And it falls in this middle ground. So it's, and the minute they start using algorithms to suppress or promote speech, you could make an argument that it's more like a newspaper or an editorial platform. But at the same time, it's a public utility, right? Because you can't exist without having access. We asked you on one of these, do you like social media? Do you not? Do you think it was good? You felt very strongly that social media was a good thing on the whole, right? I had a bit of a different opinion, but the fact is you're bound to their rules or you don't have a network to plug into.
And so
and
there,
you're handicapped.
There have been, I don't know, 10, 15 attempts at decentralized social media, right? This is kind of the utopian dream. The problem is the latest one's called FriendTech. It was done on Coinbase's platform called Base. Pretty interesting. The problem is network effect, right? People get excited and then a week later there's not enough people on it and you go right back to Twitter because everyone's on it, or you go right to Facebook. And so it's just not ready yet. And maybe when, you know, in a year or two, or if these other guys really become, you know, either regulated out or people just get sick of them, right? A lot of people left Twitter. You can't leave Twitter if you're in crypto.
Yeah.
Like crypto lives on Twitter.
Yeah.
And so you want information, you want to understand what's going on, you got to be on Twitter.
I want to say something else, right? Generally, when they've tried to solve this, like originally HTML, HTTP, that's like nonprofit, basically. It's a government, you know, you aren't going to be able to fight Facebook or Twitter as a nonprofit, right? Why crypto is so interesting, or Ethereum, is the tokenization that rewards early adopters, right? So I agree with Mike. It's been impossible in 15 years. What? It's been impossible in 15 years to compete. I mean, you haven't seen any of these.
No, I'm laughing because we may all wake up tomorrow and Business Untitled and all our pages and be going after this episode. And there's nothing we could do about it.
But in a crypto scenario, you have an ability to create an ecosystem. Say we're all driving Ubers, right? We use the Uber token, but that happens to be built on Ethereum. And that utility drives the value. So whoever's in the system first gets more value, becomes a part of that ecosystem. And so it's not for profit. It's just a different way of setting up a corporation.
You know what's interesting? When I first, 2014, I started talking about the promise of crypto. And my example was a company I called Duber. Decentralized Uber. And I had this whole token model and why it should work and how it theoretically could work. And I ran into the CEO of Uber, Travis, at one point. And the first meeting I had with him, he kind of brushed me off and like, you're full of shit. And a couple years later, I sat down with him and actually spent 2 hours. He's a lovely guy. And when I sat there, I was like, oh my goodness, how naive I was. when I looked at what it took for him to create Uber, right? He bought the supply, he bought the demand, he smashed laws. He did a lot of things that only a world-class CEO who was a freaking maniac.
Shout out to my friend Tara, who helped them do that.
who could do to build it. And it doesn't mean it's impossible for communities to get together, right? The greatest example of a giant community doing something cool in crypto was Ethereum switched from one way of authenticating their blockchain called proof of work to proof of stake. It was an immense technological and organizational move that this decentralized community did. And so there's huge power in community. But there are some things that I wonder, like how you get them up and running. And then once they're up and running, they have such network power, it's hard to unseat them. And so, listen, I've got 450 employees. I come to work every day trying to forward this crypto revolution. I'm really introspective about what parts are going to soar and what parts we're really going to need a momentum shift. And, you know, there should be a lot more decentralized systems, and we don't have them yet.
What about, I mean, NFTs would seem to be the most logical place to build that, right? I'm saying OpenSea's already built on Ethereum, effectively, right? Biggest marketplace. And there's, and right, you'd say, like, NFTs have a big use case. Forget about the speculation of, like, silly art projects, but the provenance of digital goods. So maybe that's the place that a network gets built.
Listen, there are lots of good things happening. Sometimes, you know, revolutions happen in a short period of time, and sometimes they happen in a longer period of time. What is clear to me is that the decentralized revolution is going to go slow, slow, slow until it's fast. Now, don't think I'm a pessimist. I'm so long Bitcoin is coming out my ears in Ethereum right now. Like, Bitcoin as a store of value has already won. It's going higher, right? Payment systems, right? Crypto for payments is exploding up, and there's a lot of cool new projects coming on. And tokenization is coming, which means we're going to take things that you could imagine selling 10% of a sports team in tokenized form to people that was owned by private citizens, and all of a sudden they're going to feel ownership. So we're going to have – tokenization is another form of equity, right? We're going to have lots of part of the revolution. And as that's happening, my hope and my thought is – we'll get decentralized ticketing. Yeah. We'll get decentralized. What I'm saying is that just hasn't happened yet.
Right.
And it hasn't happened yet because it's really hard to beat these network effects.
Yeah. What happens is that this podcast, I really love this podcast, not just because it's us and it's Business Untitled, shout out, but like I'm legit having anxiety thinking about the things we're talking about because it's so real and so true, right? Like I watched this movie coming back from Dubai called The Creator. Have anyone seen that?
Mm-mm.
It's with Denzel Washington's son. I can't remember his name, but something Washington. He's actually a pretty good actor. And they lived in a world in 2065 where AI got so developed that AI lived amongst humans as almost the equivalent as humans. Everything was ran by AI. And what happened, AI set off a nuclear bomb and killed 1 million people in Los Angeles. So the West decided we need to eliminate AI completely. The only place, strangely enough, that said we're going to keep AI was New Asia, right? This is a movie, by the way. But as we all know, right, a lot of things in movies we come to see really come to light. The Simpsons 10, 20 episodes.
All over the internet 2 days ago was that a bunch of the tech billionaires have put a bunch of money in, like $600 million, to build robots.
They were
all the same guys we're talking about.
So it gives me anxiety because I'm like, yo, are the things we talking about, is it gonna come to light even more and more and more? Are we, like, we go back to AI, right? When I was talking about, I built a studio recently, right? Multi-million-dollar studio I built. But it was two purposes I built it. One was for music publishing because that's been such a big, 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 big income generating thing for since music exists. There's the songwriters, there's the producers, and there's the recording studio. So you had two aspects so you could make money. And one day, I think I told you that, I just was like, yo, I think this AI thing is going to be too big for songwriters and producers to compete with it. And one of the things that really stopped me was I saw a guy, Mike Caron, who gave me my first record deal, shout out to him, who owns the one of the largest publishing companies, APG. He invested and owns a company called Gens, which is the future of songwriting and music publishing and producing, that literally you send it a text and it's, you say, hey, I want a new version of Bitcoin to the moon, and it generates that for you. So I was like, man, I don't think I should spend what would cost me millions of dollars building a traditional publishing company, because I'm so fearful that AI, which we've heard songs from The Weeknd, we've heard songs from Drake, we've heard songs from Taylor Swift, that was AI generated to their likeness, almost to a T. There's no regulation that could stop that as of right now.
On a much, much larger scale, Tyler Perry just pulled the plug on his, I think it was $800 million studio that he was building, because he was like, oh my goodness, all these actors and actresses are going to become like AI bots. And he's just worried that.
So, yeah, I'm worried. What you're talking about with the social networks, it's all boiling back to one thing, technology.
I was flying down with a bunch of friends, great investors, to Florida for our fantasy football closing dinner. And one of the guys who's one of the gurus of investing, he was like, dude, you're still using ChatGPT? Check out perplexity.ai. And so we all flipped to Perplexity. Tell you, if you're out there and you're using ChatGPT, I'd flip to Perplexity. It is just smoother, more sophisticated, has instant data. I've been asking it questions. I asked it, you know, tell me what's exciting about the Bitcoin ETF. Within 1 second, it gave me a paper, and I was like, this could be our research paper. It almost felt like it stole my speech. It's not perfect on everything, but on the Bitcoin ETF, it just nailed it. But it's nailed a ton of things. That's in 1 second.
Well,
and so this stuff is iterating so fast and getting so good, every single person is going to need to figure out how AI helps their business.
Yeah. I think to your point, though, you're talking about nothing can stop it. I mean, there's a big question out there around fair use, around the fact that these large language models are trained on all the songs that those artists did, all the movies, all the New York Times article, all the books, right? So they're basically taking all this information, training the machine on it, then spitting something out that's slightly changed music, you know, or simulating a voice and saying, oh, this is original art now. So yeah, but there's going to be a lot of litigation around
this. But that's right now, right? And I think when you listen to Elon Musk, who created, was one of the creators of ChatGPT or OpenAI or whatever. Or
Grok.
But you listen to him, and his whole thing was, we need to slow down AI because it's going to take everything over. So that's right now, right? Right now it's pulling from every source, pulling from every song. But there's a concern that it gets smart enough that it no longer has to pull from these things and can create and can't be controlled. So
You're kind of saying two things. Yeah, I guess you're saying two things. I mean, there's definitely that risk. I mean, it's going to keep getting smarter, keep creating more things. The question is, do we make make laws effectively that say, oh, you're not allowed to source the original material and then use that for the basis of your creativity. Like, it doesn't do it out of thin air. It does it because these are large, they take a ton of data, they look at it all, they discover patterns, and then they start spitting back stuff that's original, and they learn from that.
So it's Neuralink. Is that, could that be a solution in a real way?
No, I don't think so. I think the reality is AI is coming. Do we have the singularity in 5 years, 10 years, 15 years? We won't know for a while, right? There's a lot of things that look like they're all, like self-driving cars, we thought were all going to happen fast, and now it's like, oh, it's taking longer than we thought. I learned something interesting.
But I think it's going to happen eventually.
So what was interesting, here's a fact to what I learned on that plane. Shout out to hanging out with really smart guys, because you learn a lot. I said, why don't we have self-driving cars? He said, well, it's the fourth nine. I said, what do you mean? He said, in order for us to really feel comfortable, they don't have to be right 99% of the time.
Yeah.
They don't have to be right 99.9% or 99.99 or 99.999. They need to be right 99.99999. And as you go further down, it gets that much harder because you don't have even that many data points, right? Yeah. Elon, with all the driver data he gets from collecting on from Tesla, he has everyone's driving. When you come to that fourth nine, there are not that many times the cat ran in front of the car at this level, and so it's been much, much harder than we thought.
There's also
who knows when they get it, but we're not close.
There's also a phenomenon where people really hate AI, right? And what's going on in San Francisco with, was it Waymo or whatever, that car they attacked? Was it Waymo? You know, did you hear about this? No. A couple weeks ago, one of those self-driving cars driving around San Francisco, mob attacked it, like beat it, you know, basically like flipped it over, turned it on fire, but it wasn't doing anything. It's just this visceral anger at humans being displaced, you know, and it's what you're saying in the music industry to bring it that there's real outrage by artists, right? Like Bad Bunny, someone tried to rip him off or whatever. He's like, this isn't my thing. This is shit, swear jar, you know, but there's a real visceral dislike or repulsion.
But listen, right? This is the back to the music industry, right? And I think it was like 1950, actually it was 1959. The machine drum pattern was invented, right? Which today is used by every producer, every songwriter. There's different versions of it where a kid now, and the fear was the drummers who made all the drums for every song till 1959, it was like, we're gonna be out of work. We're gonna this, that, which a lot of them were out of work. Some of them switched and started understanding it. But what happened, it created more drummers, more producers, more, a more efficient way to become better at producing, right? So that's also a possibility.
That's the $64,000 question. If you saw Jensen Huang, he gave an amazing interview.
I saw that.
Where he was basically like, everyone thinks they got to run, become computer science programmers. He's like, no. That's happening for you. You need to learn how to use it in whatever you're doing.
Yeah.
Right. What are you going to ask this thing to do for you? Right. This is your this is your workforce. This is your computer science guy. And it was a weird mind shift because you would have thought, tell your kids, go study computer science. He's like, no, they missed that. It's over. Study how you use AI, how you use this tool to change things. And so, we might see one of the great productivity booms in modern era. Right. It's the one thing that could save the U.S. economy.
I was about to say, you said that on one of our podcasts. What do you mean by that exactly? Can you break that down a little bit more?
So what does productivity mean? If it used to
but you're saying AI can save us.
If it used to take us 10 hours to paint a room, right, the three of us, and now we can have a robot that really goes fast and paint it in 30 minutes, like that's a huge gain in productivity.
Yes, it is 100%. But then the three of us that used to be able to get paid for that are not out of work. Yeah. And what do we do?
So, if we own the company that paints, are we making lots of money because we've fired our labor and we've got...
More than likely, we won't. It'd be owned by one guy.
Yeah.
B, if we were people that used to work there, we've got all this time to do other things. Can we... And so
three people out of work.
So one thing that might happen, and this is a reality, we already attempted universal basic income, right? After COVID happened, we gave everyone a whole lot of money. Say, hey, take some money. I don't think it's sustainable, but we did it. Like you could see a world where so much labor gets done by robots and machines.
The only reason that just doesn't make any sense because if you see a world where a robot is eliminating jobs for productivity, which is saving the economy, this now that makes the richer and poor gap even wider.
Right. It's really hard,
right? Because
it's really hard.
I'm never gonna own an AI company. But
it's really hard to see the rich
people
poor gap.
Most people. We should have an interrupting jaw.
Yeah, we should.
Most people are not going to own an AI company. Sam Altman said it. I see a future where billion-dollar companies are ran by one man, right? So be honest. If you had an AI right now, that Galaxy would be able, and you know what? I know you, so you probably won't do it, but it doesn't mean somebody else won't do it, that you could fire all 400 or 500 employees, make
your company 10 times more efficient and fucking, another swear jar, and make your company 10 times more efficient, and it's just ran by you and AI. You, because I know who you are as a person, well, you probably won't do it, but most CEOs will.
But so,
what happens to that 400 or 500 people?
So the,
what happens what, to that
what,
workforce?
What's happened all through history? When we took the, you know, the guys who used to drive the horse and buggies, and we got cars, they had to get new jobs. People are going to have to find new things to do.
There won't be, what you're saying, I know, so what, to bring it as so, simple so as painting.
I know, so what I'm saying is, we're going to have a lot more. We're going to not work 5 days a week. We're going to work 4 days a week and then 3 days a week.
We'll make
can
less
I just,
money.
Can I just say, can I just call bullshit on that? Because that's absolute horseshit. Like, what's
Wait,
gone
what's
on?
Absolute
like,
horseshit? This,
what's on, gone on for the last 30 years, right, is wages stagnate. More money has gone into assets. The rich have gotten richer.
Well,
the
don't
and that's
that,
my
and that
point.
Is just getting accentuated by this. So
I,
there's
I,
no
I
way
disagree
that,
with that.
So if
yeah.
AI saves
so
us,
whole,
how does that not
the,
happen times 10?
The whole free time thing just doesn't work. It's just not what's going on.
What ends up happening, though, when you get this gap between rich and poor as wide as it is, and it's in every chapter in recorded history, it ends in revolution. Every single chapter, when the rich poor gap gets wide, it ends a revolution or a plague
right.
or something else that, you know, a war.
So then AI doesn't save the world. If it ends in revolution,
what
it destroys it.
No, what happens is, though, you get productivity, you start making more money, get some people up, the gap between rich and poor gets wider and wider, and you might end up having new systems. Like, we might need a whole new system. We might need universal basic income. They do it in Norway, and it worked pretty well.
Norway's 5 million people. It's not even a comparable state
I'm not,
here.
I'm not and, saying.
Okay,
I'm not
you
saying
said your piece. You said your piece, yeah. Okay? I'm saying, like, for now, for years and years, right, what's happened is the rich-poor gap has been, right, has gotten worse. The system of capitalism needs adjustment. It's why I got back to blockchain before, the tokenization, utility, like, creators and early adopters sharing, right? That is a new system at the end of the day. You're talking about revolution. Well, I hope it's not a revolution because that's going to suck for everybody, right? So some new system has to be formed because if it's just like the techno manifesto of like Andreessen or something like that, that, oh, technology is good. Well, we know that's not always the case. Social media, look, hasn't been good in so many ways. And so if you're talking about AI, all I'm saying is, I know you really want to say something bad. Just one second. Okay? I'm saying, like, if you're talking about AI, you have to recognize that this dream of just productivity doesn't do anything for the common person at the end of the
it
day.
It kills
that's
the common person.
But again,
he's saying they're going to find new jobs.
I'm just saying there is inevitability to it, and therefore we're going to have to figure out what to do with it. It is happening if you like it or not.
No, I completely agree with you. What I don't agree with is saving America.
It could save any country.
It
could save our. It could kill inflation, which helps this whole giant debt we have. Not crush us. We have less than half of America feeling good about themselves. Literally, right? You talk to the Walmart CEO came on his earnings call. He said, the bottom half of our shoppers are spending less already.
Question.
And they're credit card debt. Hold on, let me finish.
Okay.
And so we are on this trajectory, which will break at one point. It will break with revolution. It will break with something. The response might be UBI. The response might be just give people more money. The response might be... like put up gates around cities. I don't know, we're heading towards Blade Runner, the first version.
Yeah,
and I don't know what stops it.
Okay, question. Wait, how many Walmart CEOs are there?
One.
Okay. Right.
is that a trick question?
No, it is a trick question. There's one Walmart CEO. He doesn't make this shit work alone, right? How many Walmart employees, like basic general employees, you think they have?
2.5 million.
3 million. Yeah.
That they pay roughly, I'm making, just guess, they pay a year.
Minimum wage.
$15 an hour.
Yeah, I'm just saying, like, what, $1 billion?
What?
$1 billion?
A lot more than that.
A lot more than that.
Yeah.
So if they can pay, if I was a Walmart CEO, or let me just speak for myself. If I own a bunch of Bojangles, and I could save costs by spending 1 year worth of salary to bill.
Of course you do.
Yeah,
we
know that. That's how the system works.
So that's what I'm saying. What happens to, there's one CEO who benefits from it and the publicly traded thing, but what happens to those millions of employees?
Listen, This is where another system, has to come into play, okay? There's no disagreement that the system of capitalism, in fact, of our corporations is such that you must maximize for profitability, essentially. That's the rules. The rules are you have to maximize.
I agree with that completely.
So I'm saying, of course, that's going to be the result, right? Another system has to take hold that hopefully is not revolution. And why I was going back to previously, tokenization, which I do think like is misunderstood. It hasn't come on yet, but it's not, if you can't change the paradigm of how many people are owning the means of production, right? Mm-hmm. Without going to communism, because we know that's a totally different non-working system, and adjust capitalism so that there's a better way that the proceeds of early adopters, early workers, people that help build the value of the company can also be take some of that value in a gamified way, which is what tokenization kind of does. I mean, there's an alternative. I know it's a long way away from happening right now, but technology itself will just keep putting us into this rabbit hole.
There's a book called The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism, which we all...
I think that's what I was actually trying to say.
Which broadly stated way back, and this was probably written in, 1700s, that capitalism works because we have religion. When it was written, it gives us some rules that doesn't allow us just to let capitalism run rampant, right? There is some moral revolution that is needed, right? CEOs in Europe get paid a whole lot less than CEOs in America, not because they're worse, because the culture says we don't think it's fair, right? Aristotle wrote the CEO shouldn't make more than 10 times yeah. what an average employee makes. We have CEOs making 600, 700 times. And so at one point, like something has got to bend. That's what politics is.
Yeah.
Politics says these are the rules we're going to play by. And if it's going to be, if we're going to smush social media companies, if we're going to tax wealthy people at 90%. In the 1970s, the top marginal tax rate was 90%.
Yeah, but there was a million tax shelters to get around, number one. And number two, Europe is a calcified mess because it's basically a socialist.
I'm not arguing for any of these. I'm saying that these are the things we're going to run into.
None of them work.
Agreed.
Yeah.
I am very pessimistic.
Unless
that we're heading towards Blade Runner. But we're going to try some things.
Yeah. I'm saying it is a needle to thread. And I think that, you know, we started this whole thing on blockchain because I think there's a lot of misinformation about what the utility of this, you know, forget about decentralized, like a new protocol where the rules are predictable, right? That's what I'm talking about, where it's not that Facebook or somebody, A, sucks all the value to the middle, and B, can cut you off whenever they want, right? More akin to how websites were built. And I think there's got to be, you know, that's what I think is interesting about blockchain at the end of the day, is that it sets up a system where maybe, just maybe, there's a way that early adopters, creators, right, that it's a flatter system and there's more wealth that's shared in that system effectively.
You think about what Satoshi's great breakthrough was, right? Satoshi created private property on the internet for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
Before the Bitcoin white paper, there was no private property on the internet. There is no capitalism without private property. Mm-hmm. Right? George Washington said there is no freedom without private property, right? And so this idea that you could have private property means we could attack these feudal, like the internet until Satoshi was feudal, and it was the lords of, you know, Facebook and Google, and we would sell our data. We get
still
paid
is.
For it. We get paid for it. I know, but so the promise or the hope of crypto was like you could attack those walled gardens, those feudal areas with other systems. I'm praying that still happens. It potentially helps, right? It helps creators. It helps artists. It helps coders. It helps so many things. This is my wealth. Yeah. It even things like with your DNA, right? Right now, you give your DNA, no one care. Like 23andMe took everyone's DNA, or Ancestry.com. You know, you kind of got fooled into giving your DNA. There could be a system where you give your DNA and it's protected, and you get paid when they use it.
Right.
Like there are lots of ways to give value or money back to people. It's really hard to build those systems. They haven't been built yet. But something needs to happen or we're going to look like Blade Runner.
I want to say this about 23andMe. I don't think a lot of people know this, but if you ever took 23andMe, as cool as it was, you literally signed over your DNA to them.
Yeah.
You no longer own your DNA.
Same thing with Ancestry.com.
You give it to 23andMe. Same thing with them.
You know, 23andMe bus. But anyway, Dave, you was talking about something earlier. Let's talk about real estate. You feel a little bit. It's like a cool, creative, I don't know if it's going to work, play that was happening that you was talking about with IKEA. Can you tell us about that?
You know, there's been a lot of speculation around real estate, reuse of real estate. It's obviously been a very tough market, particularly for commercial real estate, malls, office buildings. But I read today, which I thought was pretty cool, that IKEA has gotten into like owning the mall business. They're pairing up with co-working, kind of like, I think it was Industrious they were doing it, but I just thought it was interesting where they're kind of remaking malls in a way, because I was pretty pessimistic on most of these reuse things. I think most of these malls are, you know, pretty hard to reuse and have lost their purpose, but I thought it was kind of an interesting article where they're pairing co-working services, things like gyms and medical services, haircuts, things like that, along with co-working and limited retail food and beverage. But I just thought it was like a bright light, a bit of hope in like what's a pretty bleak, you know, commercial real estate.
I thought it was one of the coolest things.
I don't know, as a developer,
you think it could work?
I do think it could work.
Five years ago, I remember them trying it with building apartments, and they were like they were going to build little mini villages where there was going to be residential plus all that stuff.
Yeah. So I don't think it works for residential. That's where I think this thing was interesting.
Services.
I think residential in a mall is a bad fit. Yeah. We've read a lot about it, but they tend to sit off highways, right? They got ramps and parking lots, and it's not a place you want to live. But for offices, it's different. You know, the office, it's like you go. If you think about suburban offices,
I see what you're saying.
They're soulless bags of crap in the middle of these highways anyway. So might as well use a mall, which is meant for socializing, retail, a little bit of walking.
I got it.
It makes sense to me in a way that it hadn't made sense before, and I think IKEA's got the cred to pull it off because they got a healthy business. They can anchor that mall with a store, some furniture. They draw a lot of traffic. So I thought it was one of the more interesting.
Will it be robbing from Peter to pay Paul? So like, it becomes a much more vibrant suburban office park if you think about it. And then the old, as you call, bag of crap office building really then.
Well, I think there's two things that come out of that. If you were in the suburban office market over the last 30 years, you got crushed. It was a shit place to be. Anybody that sold that made out, because it's really been terrible because they're terrible assets. It could pull from other office buildings. It could pull from the city even a little. But look, it's all about revitalization, reuse. You know, you got to go where the demand is. I thought it was just an interesting, creative way to reuse. And it's the first one I've heard in a while that's not bad.
Yeah, actually, I like it a lot.
It's interesting. The only place where I've read about where there's like commercial coming back is San Fran, because AI is bringing all this talent back to, you know, the four biggest AI companies in the world are based in San Fran. And so as much as everyone hated San Fran for a while because there was poop on the streets and, you know, they're coming back. And so the office building market is coming back. Yeah. Are you seeing it come back anywhere else?
I'm not. I don't have a lot of office exposure. I don't think it's coming back. I think it's stabilized off the bottom, if I would say, in places like, particularly like New York and San Francisco, because they're always supply constrained to some degree, right? I think the Sun Belt markets are even worse. I mean, people talk about Austin and Dallas, and they're great markets, but they got a lot of office space, a lot of vacancy. To be fair, I haven't seen it. I think it's off the bottom. That's what
it still could be a shoe to drop on the economy that this, we haven't dealt with this. You know, offices literally. So I was reading some stories. Things are trading at 20 cents on the dollar over where they were 6 years ago. And so whoever lent that money is SOL.
Yeah, because offices have a double problem, right? Residential, at least you have strong rents for the most part. Yeah, they've come off a little bit lately, but you have more offices. You have rents that have been declining, big vacancies, and you got mortgage rates through the roof. No buyers. Everybody's sitting on the sidelines. So it's kind of like a perfect storm in office. And in general, in real estate, until we get a little more clarity on where the 10-year is heading, right, it's gonna take a minute to shake out. Where's the 10-year gonna be in 2 years?
I've been short and losing. It's interesting. The economy is slowing, but it's kind of bucking around, and it's probably around 5% in 2 years.
You think the 10-year is going up to 5%?
Yeah.
You think it's going up?
Because the curve will steepen, right?
Yeah.
Maybe 4% in 10 years.
It's hard for me to believe that this government can survive with a 5% 10-year with all the debt that they have out there. It feels to me like they have to figure out a way to push it down.
When they start pushing the front down, the back comes up a little bit, right? It's just interesting.
The curve is
abnormally flat.
I think short terms have to go down.
And so that normally pressures the back. Let's end on something fun. When I was slaving away here in New York, you guys were in the Mideast and just got back. Impressions of Dubai, impressions of that whole part of the world.
We're moving to Dubai next week. We got a new guy to like replace you on a podcast.
Shout out Oliver Ripley or Larry Morrow.
I thought Dubai was amazing. I've been there many times over the years, but like every time I go back, it's better. This time it was just off the hook. It had a palpable energy. It was just moving. There was people from all different countries, all different places. It was just hopping. It was like New York
90s.
In the 80s or 90s. We had our friend Larry Morrow with us. Shout out to Larry Morrow. He's the best. And he was like, man, this feels like the future. This is amazing. Like it was just such an energy. You couldn't get over it.
It's like 5 years, 7 years ago, you go to Dubai and you'd be like, okay, one day is good.
Yeah.
Two days a lot. It's almost like Vegas.
Yeah.
I think it's still like, for me, it's probably still like a 4-day thing max, and then you want to go to fuck home, but it was really nice. But I think for me, one of the best parts of it was going to Qatar. I've never been to Qatar before. And I think what happens when you travel, you get to meet such dope people, and it brings you back to like rich, poor, whatever. You get to realize, wow, and you always say it, that rich guy or that person from Qatar or that person from China or that person from, they take a shit on the same toilet I take a shit on. And you get to realize, man, these people are just as dope as people you may meet in America. And you may meet some bad ones, you may meet some good ones, but it's still just people, you know? And I think that was like such a dope lesson for me. Not a lesson in a sense, but it was so dope to meet some dope people in a part of the world that, you know, I have never got a chance to, and realize I met a lot of dope people out there in Qatar, and it was just
we're gonna
really
start
cool
finding
you
if you use the word dope one more time.
It's so funny, right? We're 17 minutes in now, right? He wanted to end. I have a dinner. I gotta go. But every time he wanted to interrupt you and continue to go, his time got more flexible.
I asked about the place you were. I was sitting here grinding away.
That was his, bro, he's so smart, and that's why I love him. He's wickedly smart. He knew he interrupted and like, so he wanted to just lessen the load. How was your trip, guys, now that I've already manipulated you into speaking for 7 more minutes of my time? You got to go, Mr. Novogratz?
Hey, it's been a great episode of Business Untitled. We'll be back soon. And
we got some really cool guests coming.
We do. We've got the guests. We're going to start rolling the guests in again, but we just like talking ourselves. Peace out.
Peace.